All right, Happy New Year to everyone. We have an article entitled, Have Smartphones Destroy the Generation? I don't know if we'll be able to get through the whole thing in one setting, or we'll do it in part one and part two. It's pretty lengthy, but let's get started. And something crazy and new, Nate, why don't you demonstrate your proficiency in leading us through an article?
I'll do my best.
Our author, by the way, is Gene M. Twinge.
Twinge, yeah.
She is a professor at San Diego University.
One day last summer, around noon, I called Athena, a 13-year-old who lives in Houston, Texas. She answered her phone. She's had an iPhone since she was 11. Sounding as if she'd just woken up, we chatted about her favorite songs and TV shows, and I asked her what she likes to do with her friends. We go to the mall, she said. Do your parents drop you off? I asked, recalling my own middle school days in the 1980s when I'd enjoy a few parent-free hours shopping with my friends. No, I go with my family, she replied. We'll go with my mom and brothers and walk a little behind them. I just have to tell my mom where we are going. I have to check in every hour or every 30 minutes. Those mall trips are infrequent. About once a month, more often Athena and her friends spend time together on their phones, unchaperoned. Unlike the teens of my generation who might have spent an evening tying up the family landline with gossip, they talk on Snapchat, the smartphone app that allows users to send pictures and videos that quickly disappear. They make sure to keep up their snap streaks, which show how many days in a row they have Snapchatted with each other. Sometimes they save screenshots of particularly ridiculous pictures of friends. It's good blackmail, Athena said. Because she's a minor, I'm not using her real name. She told me she'd spent most of the summer hanging out alone in her room with her phone. That's just the way her generation is, she said. We didn't have a choice to know any life without iPads or iPhones. I think we like our phones more than we like actual people. I've been researching generational differences for 25 years, starting when I was a 22-year-old doctoral student in psychology. Typically, the characteristics that come to define a generation appear gradually and along a continuum. Beliefs and behaviors that were already rising simply continue to do so. Millennials, for instance, are a highly individualistic generation. But individualism have been increasing since the baby boomers turned on, tuned in, and dropped out. I have grown accustomed to line graphs of trends that looked like modest hills and valleys. Then I began studying Athena's generation around 2012. I noticed abrupt shifts in teen behaviors and emotional states. The gentle slopes of the line graphs became steep mountains and sheer cliffs. And many of the distinctive characteristics of the millennial generation began to disappear. In all of my analysis of generational data, some reaching back to the 1930s, I have never seen anything like it.
Brian.
The allure of independence, so powerful to previous generations, holds less sway over today's teens. At first, I presumed these might be blips, but the trends persisted across several years and a series of national surveys. The changes weren't just in degree, but in kind. The biggest difference between the millennials and their predecessors was in how they viewed the world. Teens today differ from the millennials, not just in their views, but in how they spend their time. The experiences they have every day are radically different from those of the generation that came of age just a few years before them. What happened in 2012 to cause such a dramatic shift in behavior? It was after the Great Recession, which officially lasted from 2007 to 2009, and had a starker effect on millennials trying to find a place in a sputtering economy. But it was exactly the moment when the proportion of Americans who own smartphones surpassed 50%.
So 2012 is the year that we crossed this threshold, is what the author is communicating.
Yeah, more people had smartphones than who did not. The more I pored over yearly surveys of teen attitudes and behaviors, the more I talked with young people like Athena. The clearer it became that theirs is a generation shaped by the smartphone and the You looked this one up, Doc.
I did. Concomitant.
Concomitant, meaning naturally accompanying or associated with the rise of social media. I call them iGen, born between 1995 and 2012. Members of this generation are growing up with smartphones, have an Instagram account before they start high school, and do not remember a time before the internet. The millennials grew up with the web as well, but it wasn't ever present in their lives, at hand at all times, day and night. iGen's oldest members were early adolescents when the iPhone was introduced, in 2007, and high school students when iPad entered the scene in 2010. A 2017 survey of more than 50,000 American teens found that 3 out of 4 owned an iPhone. The advent of the smartphone and its cousin, the tablet, was followed quickly by hand-wringing about the deleterious effects of screen time. But the impact of these devices has not been fully appreciated, and goes by far beyond the usual concern about curtailed attention spans. The arrival of the smartphone has radically changed every aspect of teenagers' lives, from the nature of their social interactions to their mental health. These changes have affected young people in every corner of the nation and in every type of household. The trends appear among teens, poor and rich, of every ethnic background, in cities, suburbs, and small towns, where there are cell towers, there are teens living their lives on the smartphone. To those of us who fondly recall a more analog adolescence, this may seem foreign and troubling. The aim of generational study, however, is not to succumb to nostalgia for the way things used to be. It's to understand how they are now. Some generational changes are positive, some are negative, and many are both. More comfortable in their bedrooms than in a car or at a party, today's teens are physically safer than teens have ever been. They're marked less likely to get into car accidents and having less of a taste for alcohol than their predecessors, and less susceptible to drinking's attendant ills. Psychologically, however, they are more vulnerable than millennials were. Rates of teen depression and suicide have skyrocketed since 2011. It's not an exaggeration to describe iGen as being on the brink of the worst mental health crisis in decades. Much of this deterioration can be traced to their phones. Even when a seismic event, a war, a technological leap, a free concert in the mud, plays an outsized role in shaping the ground of young people, no single factor ever defines a generation. Parenting styles continue to change, as do school curricula and culture, and these things matter. But the twin rise of the smartphone and social media has caused an earthquake of a magnitude we've not seen in a very long time, if ever. There's a compelling evidence that the devices we've placed in young people's hands are having profound effects on their lives and making them seriously unhappy. In the early 1970s, the photographer Bill Yates shot a series of portraits at the Sweetheart Roller Skating Rink in Tampa, Florida. In one, a shirtless teen stands with a large bottle of peppermint schnapps stuck in the waistband of his jeans. In another, a boy who looks no older than 12 poses with a cigarette in his mouth. The rink was a place where kids could get away from their parents and inhabit a world of their own, a world where they could drink, smoke, and make out in the backs of their cars. In stark black and white, the adolescent boomers gaze at Yates' camera with the self-confidence born of making your own choices, even if, perhaps especially if, your parents wouldn't think they were the right ones. 15 years later, during my own teenage years as a member of Generation X, smoking had lost some of its romance, but independence was definitely still in. My friends and I plotted to get our driver's license as soon as we could, making DMV appointments for the day we turned 16 and using our newfound freedom to escape the confines of our suburban neighborhood. Asked by our parents, "When will you be home?" we replied, "When do I have to be?" But the allure of independence, so powerful to previous generations, holds less sway over today's teens, who are less likely to leave their house without their parents. The shift is stunning. 12th graders in 2015 were going out less often than 8th graders did as recently as 2009.
All right, let's stop there. That's 2.5 pages. Thoughts so far? For those of you guys that read it for the very first time, what was going through your mind?
My parents met at a skating rink.
It's hard to believe it's only been 12 years since an iPhone came out and only 10 since the iPad. It's just, I don't know.
Flown by?
What's that?
Flown by, you're saying?
Yes. It seems like they've been around for way longer than that.
Right.
It's like a third of my life.
Now, that last section, that last paragraph we read, that 2015 12th graders were only going out as frequently as 8th graders were in 2009. Yeah. That blows my mind. Like, what? Like,
well, now they can hang out with their friends on any video game. They can talk and Snapchat on the phone. They don't have to go see each other. The one girl, I think, at the very beginning says, we don't even really like people. We just like our phones, our devices. Where I'd say that differ when I remember it was like almost every other weekend I was trying to go to a friend's house or have friends over because I wanted to hang out with
every day after school. It was like, what do I have to do so I can go out and play in the neighborhood?
Mm-hmm.
And for the listener, Nathan and I are only 30 and 31. We're not.
You're 31.
Right? Yeah. I got a year on you. Mm-hmm. So we're not even, you know, we're getting more older now.
I mean, the big thing that jumped out at me was just the lack of the desire to be independent in today's teens. You know, they're satisfied to stay at home, to have their parents drive them around, to really just coddle them.
Yeah, the perpetuated adolescence.
Right, that concept. But and again, I can remember as a teenager, I don't know, you know, you wanted your independence. You wanted to be able to go do, you know, even if it was just on your bicycle, you know. It's like,
yes.
You know, I wanted to fix the flat tire on my bike just so I could go out in the neighborhood on my own. But I also understand today's parents, you know, the children can't leave the street or leave the side of the house because they're afraid they might get snatched and taken.
That'd be an interesting, study to see is, and this is definitely pointing fingers at technology, and it's definitely to blame, but I wonder to what degree children have reacted to the parental shift where it was, I mean, growing up in the 90s for me, you know, even even later than that, into the early 2000s. You know, it was, okay, hey, Mom, I'm going to go ride my bike and I'm going to go down to Cody's house, one of my neighborhood friends growing up. I was like, okay, I'll be back by this time. Or, you know, street lights.
Yes.
Yep. You know, that was still a popular thing. Oh, yep. Don't leave this area. Don't go in anyone's, you know, there were still guidelines. But whereas now, I mean, even with my children right now, it's like, we got a family across the street that I hate for Michael to go inside the house. You know, even when we're standing right there in the driveway talking to the parents. I mean, just that mentality and how our culture today is, the parents are more overprotective. And as a result, well, if my parents won't let me do anything, then I'll just stay in my room and I'll find refuge in digital friends or digital connection with my friends.
John, nothing.
Well, I mean, she said it well. I mean, I don't know what else you could say. It is spot on.
Well, let's keep reading that.
Today's teens are less likely to date. The initial stage of courtship, which Gen Xers called liking, as in, ooh, he likes you, kids now call talking, an ironic choice for a generation that prefers texting to actual conversation. After two teens have talked for a while, they might start dating. But only about 56% of high school seniors in 2015 went out on dates. For boomers and Gen Xers, the number was about 85%. The decline in dating tracks with a decline in sexual activity. The drop is the sharpest for ninth graders, among whom the number of sexually active teens has been cut by almost 40% since 1991. The average teen now has had sex for the first time by the spring of 11th grade, a full year later than the average Gen Xer. Fewer teens having sex has contributed to what many see as one of the most positive youth trends in recent years. The teen birth rate hit an all-time low in 2016, down 67% from its modern peak in 1991. I think that's probably missing some information because I'd want to know the number of abortions that are accompanying that. Because decreased teen birth, not teen pregnancy. Because not all pregnancies in our culture today, not all teen pregnancies end in teen parenting.
Well, if you don't live in a house, it's very hard to have a physical relationship.
This is true.
If both parties aren't leaving the house, it's very hard to have a physical relationship. So she's defining.
Is it very hard or is it impossible? I'm just kind of curious about that.
You get what I'm saying.
Well, if my parents take me over.
The physical activity is what she's talking about with sexual activity. I would charge you parents to consider this fact. They not may not be physical flesh to flesh, but they very well may be flesh to eye. Now, I didn't say anything in the first pause. Snapchat, I'm going to say it again. College guys made Snapchat. They still own Snapchat. They're not college guys anymore. They made it to allure and get naked images of college girls because they can store them on their server and they can sell them for a price. And every photo sent through Snapchat, though it disappears from the phone, is owned by the Snapchat company. And it is stored, and it is subpoenable in court systems, and it could be being sold and marketed in foreign nations and in foreign areas where child pornography laws are much lower. And that's the danger of letting your kid go to the bedroom with their phone. The reason for suicide is because of the brain chemical dopamine. That's why they're depressed. They're immediately going to see how many number of likes they got seconds after posting something, or who responded to something, or who sent a thumbs up, or whatever the latest, greatest trend is to show that, yeah, we approve of what you're posting. TikTok is an absolute idiot zone, mm-hmm. In which they have now learned all that they need to know about the upcoming World War III, and they're depressed and upset over that. TikTok is their new go-to. In that process.
And TikTok is what, Jack?
It is, well, it's kind of a hodgepodge of everything, isn't it? It's their self-made videos. It's their sing-alongs to songs.
That's what I see it as, the most popular.
And they get to basically be their own star for a moment and be their own entertainer. And so they have the seclusiveness of the bedroom in which they're in gives them the ability to be more foolish than they would be in public. Our generation had to work very hard to engage in sinful activities. And that's just a fact of it. They ain't talking about the 1970s skating rink and everything else and the pictures and stuff like that, but it was very few that were brave enough to step in front of a camera and actually give it out. That's why they wouldn't talk about the squeaky board so much in the house when you're trying to sneak back in and not wake up mom and dad. That type of thing. It's why you wanted a car and everything else, because it was the only time that you could get out away from adults enough to actually act stupid and do stupid things. They're already doing it, and they don't have to leave home to do it.
Well, and, you know, for me growing up, like, it was an... And I'm in that generation, I'm right on the edge of the millennial generation, where my dad was a computer guy, so internet was, you know, came into my house a little faster than a lot of my friends, and by faster, I mean... quicker in time, but as it was coming in, I also had faster connection because my dad, you know, did that for a living. But, I mean, television and things like that, I mean, my generation, it was a TV in your room. And I had parents that were dead set against having a television in our room. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, there was only so much they could even come across on cable television because of federal regulations and rating systems and things like that and what your parents paid for. But we go and we allow students to have cell phones. I mean, in my youth group of 7th to 12th graders, there's maybe a handful, maybe five, that don't have a cell phone. And they're like 7th graders. They're 8th graders that have just turned, you know, or are about to turn into the teenage years. But everyone that's at least freshman and up, they have cell phones. And I just kind of wonder, to what degree are parents today controlling a cell phone like my parents or, you know, my generation's parents of televisions in the room or, you know, different things that they could take privately to their room where their door would be closed, where there would be secrecy or privacy to it. Because I don't think even in our church we have as many parents today being proactive with, no, the cell... I mean, I know a few families that, hey, cell phone doesn't go in the room. But we don't have that across the board where that's just, no, it's my alarm.
is always the cop-out.
Yeah, and that I think she brings that up in the article later, that it was an astonishing percentage of these, what does she call the new iGens, actually have their phone like on the bed at night with them or under their pillow.
Yeah.
And that's their, well, it's my alarm. You know, it's what I use, you know, but...
I use my phone as my alarm, but...
But they're also, yeah, looking at it whenever they wake up in the middle of the night or staying up late and not going to sleep.
I have my phone in the other room.
Yeah. Do you remember growing up, I don't know if your radio, local radio station carried it, but there used to be this thing where we grew up in Michigan called the Chapel of the Air.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And they had the 40 days where it was like a 40-day kind of daily revival thing, and it was a prayer. I think it was geared towards prayer, and I just wonder if could we even go 40 days without our phone if we made like a commitment as a, you know, a church or a family that to go 40 days without using your phone.
I don't know how you would. How can I, for 40 days, I'm not going to make a single phone call?
Yeah, what was that thing called, the 40 days?
That's because, I mean...
I'm getting it confused with the 40 days of purpose, yeah. what was later
but
on.
But now, I mean, how many in this room even still have house phones?
I don't. Yeah. No. We do, but it's not hooked up.
That doesn't count.
I know.
Right? It's in the box. I mean...
I don't know how you go.
So, I mean, and that's why we couldn't. I mean, because now my connectivity to even phone calls is not through a landline anymore. It's through this device. So, I mean, we couldn't. I mean, my parents still have one. It's annoying as all get out.
But you remember those days when, like, if you were driving or you're out and you weren't at your house to answer your phone, you didn't answer your phone?
It's true.
Well, I don't have... Just because my phone rings doesn't mean I answer it.
Right.
No, I mean, there's plenty of times that I choose not to answer my phone. Just like an answering machine.
And other folks didn't. But
yeah.
Depends who calls.
Like, I never had an answering machine.
You don't have to answer your phone just because you have it, right?
Yeah.
Right.
But that takes maturity. Just like when I wake up in the middle of the night, it takes maturity not to pick it up and look at it. Because I discovered years ago that if I... The blue light filter, that I had started to notice that it bothered me if I looked at my phone too late at night before going to bed, or, you know, even now I just make a decision if I wake up or if one of the boys wakes me up in the middle of the night that my phone stays face down until the alarm goes off.
Even driving, a symbol of adolescent freedom inscribed in American popular culture from Rebel Without Cause to Ferris Bueller's Day Off has lost its appeal for today's teens. Nearly all boomer high school students had their driver's license by the spring of their senior year. More than one out of four teens today still lack one at the end of high school. For some, mom and dad are such good chauffeurs that there's no urgent need to drive. My parents drove me everywhere and never complained, so I always had rides. A 21-year-old student in San Diego told me, I didn't get a license until my mom told me I had to because she could not keep driving me to school. She finally got her license 6 months after her 18th birthday. In conversation after conversation, teens describe getting their license as something to be nagged into their parents, a notion that would have been unthinkable to previous generations.
I want to chime in on this one as well. Not that, I mean, I see it, and there's definitely that, you know, we've addressed it, that coddling. But I wonder to what degree car insurance rates play into this. I mean, what was car insurance like for... You know,
I don't know. My mom and dad felt like it was, when I came on the policy, it was through the roof, and it was clear if I was going to get a car, I had to pay for my insurance. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a proportional thing, Brian.
I mean, obviously, you know, the dollar amount would have been different, but I mean, that's helpful for me to understand, because I remember when I turned 16, you know, and wanted my driver's license, my parents were like, no, not till you're 18. I mean, and so I had permits for 2 years. You know, because my parents were like, no, we're not paying for car insurance like that. So, well, I'm sure.
What about you? What'd you do, Nate?
Drove illegally. He lived in Missouri.
Well, that's true.
He had tractor insurance.
Well, yeah, we had a farm truck for David Redd, and I remember I was driving 14, going to the pig farm, and building fence, and we had an old farm truck. But that was county roads. We were hardly ever on the highway.
Yeah, whereas I grew
up
in
when I turned, I think it was 15, it was like within a week I got my permit, and then I had that. And then when I turned 16, it was like within 2 or 3 days I went and got my license. And
What about you, Steve?
Yeah. Well, I grew up in New Jersey, so you had to be 17 before you get a license. I was in college at the time.
Right.
And so, and, you know, my parents, you know, they, I didn't get my license right away because of the insurance. They didn't have the money, and my dad was like, you're at college, you don't need to drive anyway. So it wasn't until, I don't think I ended up getting it until he actually moved out to go to seminary to Indiana, and I started working, and then I paid for my own.
Jack?
At 14, I got my permit, and the insurance rates didn't go up for a permitted driver. Then at 16, it automatically rolls over into a driver's license, and at that point, my parents made me have my own policy.
Oh, wow.
I was not on their policy at all, because I was considered too expensive to be on their policy. So
it was even more expensive to have your own.
I had liability on my 1982 Mustang, and
you had a Chevette, it would have been a lot cheaper.
So my car payment was $88 and my insurance was $100. Mm-hmm. Gas was 98 cents, and I worked 3 part-time jobs after school.
John, what about you?
Well, as soon
Who's older, by the way, John? You're older than Jack, right? He just turned 48. He's a young guy.
Yeah, I'm older.
I'm in the middle of the pack.
As soon as my parents could get me driving so they didn't have to wake up and take me to school, I got my license and everything. So I got my permit right away, and I got my license as soon as I turned 16, so I could drive back and forth to school, and they didn't have to be bothered with it.
Yep.
Take my brother.
See, I was the youngest, so for me I got everything faster than my older siblings did because of the, I'd say generational difference, but my sister was in college and she got her driver's license. My brother was older than that. And for me, it was...
They were sick of driving everybody else around, so yeah.
That's right. It was
like, that's how, yeah, my dad...
Get this guy caught.
We drove out to Montana. My dad didn't want to drive, so I drove out to Montana. That's how I learned how to drive.
You know, we're sitting here and a little thought popped in my head, guys. I wonder how much the overprotectiveness came out because of, what was that TV show?
America's Most Wanted?
Well, not only America's Most Wanted, but what was the one? I saw it recently and it was
Unsolved,
like,
Mysteries?
Yeah, the guy came up and he was like, and he did this. But no, the one where the guy, his son had been kidnapped and killed.
That was America's Most Wanted.
Was that America's Most Wanted? Yeah, his son Adam had been, John Walsh.
Yeah, I remember, I know the show you're talking about.
I wonder
about
how much that, Unsolved Mysteries, the kidnapping of the children in Atlanta, where we first got the creeper van references because they were using the white panel vans that workers use. In cable TV, CNN.
Just scared parents to death.
Yes, because it wasn't just in Atlanta anymore. All of a sudden, it was broadcast into rural America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I wonder how much that played into...
How much the technology played into...
No, how much? Because, Bianca was born in 1995, and she doesn't have her driver's license. So this is definitely talking about, and she'd be one of the older ones. And I told them all along, we need to quit taking her places. But then, well, by the time college came around, she found people to take her places. One of them, her husband, eventually.
So she still doesn't have her license?
Nope. No, that's one of the reasons why she loves her sister living close as she does to her, so that she can ride into work at the same time every day.
Does she know she can save money on car insurance by
switching to Geico
by doing a multi-driver discount?
But she says she has no need for it. She sees no need in having one because she has enough people around her that will support her. But it's just that same mindset. Wow. But the thing of it is. I wonder how many of us, I'm a Generation X, how many of us look back and said, you know what, and maybe I did this and I didn't realize it. I look back and said, you know what, I can't believe my parents let me do X, Y, and Z, and it led to sin A, B, and C, leave them unnamed, and it became, I don't want that for my children, I want my children raised differently, therefore they're not going to have... or whatever, but since they can't have that, here's a phone, here's this, here's that, so that you still have a sense of something in the world.
Maybe for a Christian, but I don't see that in the unsafe community. You know, you see dads that are celebrating their, you know, the 18th or whatever birthday to share a beer with them and whatever.
Yeah, but maybe not with the alcohol and the sex, Steve. But there's definitely that prevalence in why they bring them to our academy.
You mean because it's safe?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely because of that. Or they don't want them exposed to this, and this until they're old enough to be ready for it, and that's why we see a mass exodus in high school. But that's why we see a prevalence of them being in our academies in elementary and middle school.
We should tell those parents that they're not ready for it in high school.
You can try.
Yeah. Well, but, I mean, I've said it for 30 years, really, but the same thought that she's brought out is every year it just seems like children are getting less mature. You know, 31 years ago when the first year, I had 7th grade homeroom, and they were mature, I loved the 7th and 8th graders. But By the way,
no one says that today, okay? You can't find anyone that says, I love 7th and 8th graders.
Right. I know, but I did. I mean, I had a blast with 7th and 8th graders. It was fun to teach them. I mean, they still had their innocence. They didn't cop attitudes. And they were just fun to interact with. You could, you know, tease them and joke and whatever. You know, by the time they became seniors and the next 7th graders had come up, they were like babies. You know, you'd joke with them and they'd cry or, you know, whatever, or go home and tell their mommy and, you know, Mr. Wilson said this. And, you know, it's like, what am I dealing with? You know, I'm like, good night. These kids are like elementary kids.
And how long has it been since you taught that?
And then by the time they got to be seniors, literally, you know, 10 years down, you know, the next group of 7th graders, you know, in proportion, it's like I'm teaching preschoolers, and it was just like, you know, I can't handle this. I was like, but yes, and that might be a little bit of a stretch, but not much. But you can see that
less and less maturity.
The decline in maturity in children, in students. And I have always looked at, you know, you look at that and say, what's going on? Why is that happening?
Well, there's also a marked decrease in critical thinking. Because they're not forced.
For us.
Well, the thing of it is okay, and a comedian was talking about it, and I'll use his as an example because it was so wonderfully done. He said, when I was growing up, he goes, somebody told me, hey, did you know if you put dry ice in a Coke bottle, it'll blow up? So I ran up to and I said, where'd I get dry ice? He's like, the ice cream man keeps it. So when the ice cream truck came through, I ran to the ice cream truck and I'm like, hey, can I buy some dry ice? He said, what are you going to do with it, boy? Oh, put it in a bottle and see if it blows up. All right, here you go. And he hands me the dry ice. That night at the dinner table, mom's picking glass out of my face. My dad comes in and goes, what happened? I put some dry ice in a bottle and it blew up in my face. He goes, you going to do it again? No. He's like, all right, you learned your lesson. You know, and there was this, we do stupid things, we get hurt, we learn.
Today we see the ice cream man.
But the thing of it is they don't even know what the ice cream man is. They don't get to go out and experience the ice cream man. They live a risk-free life. They're going to be more immature. This is why Jordan Peterson, in his 12 Rules of Life, put one of the rules as, when you see kids skateboarding, don't stop them. The idea of, if you see them out there taking a risk, let them be injured. Not gravely injured, but he goes, but today, you see a kid skateboarding and we pass laws. Well, you can't skateboard without a helmet. You can't skateboard without knee pads. You can't skateboard without this.
Yeah, I wish somebody would have stopped me when I was a teenager, because when I got mine for Christmas, I went to the top of the hill and got on. I thought, this looks, you know, it looked easy. Wiped out about halfway down. That was the end of my skateboards.
How much of this, John, do you think is different with socioeconomic differences? Because your children grew up relatively poor. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, I think so. And I, Steve mentioned a minute ago asking yourself, what in the world's going on? And I think we can track some trends, and that is, as we become more affluent, a couple of things happen. You know, first of all, in order to become more fluent, both parents are working now more than they used to. Mm-hmm. So there's this sort of an absence of any type of parental, you know, regardless whether it's the man or the woman. And then the, like you mentioned, is the lack of risk or the lack of, let's turn it in the sense you're talking about, Pastor, and that is of doing without something. You know, so we used to have to be inventive. You know, we didn't have all the tools for hockey, so we found a stick and we stapled another stick to it and made a hockey stick and then started, you know, knocking a ball around or something, you know. And all of those things, like, you know, running outside, you go outside and find a good activity. You know, climb a tree. You know, we used to go into the woods, you know, by our house for hours and just throw dirt clogs at each other. And all of those things came because we didn't have
movie about that now.
Yeah. We didn't have the best bikes. I mean, the bikes we had are the ones we found on the side of the road and put together. So we learned how wheels come on and off bikes and chains come on and off bikes. And
couldn't
so,
just buy a new one. You had to fix your old one.
Right. And so...
find one to fix.
And we had to share them. I mean, we didn't all have bikes. You know, so I think it also goes to the sense of community and, like, you know, getting along with one another. We didn't... You know, the answer today is we're fighting over the phone. Well, let's buy the other one a phone. No. You know?
Yeah.
And I just recently gone through with my grandkids, and we had like a after-action report after all the grandkids left, and my wife and I are talking about, you know, things about parenting and observing things we observe, and one of them is, you know, the tendency is when all the family gets together, the parents want to defend their child when there's an altercation over an item or a toy. You know, I just told my wife, and she might disagree with me just a little bit, but I like, let them go at it for a while. Rush over there, and I want to see. First of all, I want to see who's the strongest. You know, so
that,
I can understand.
That'd be my boy.
So I can understand this hierarchy here. You know, and secondly, you know,
survival of the fittest.
Some of them, and you know, and I'm not for doing what's wrong. I mean, they're expressing their sinful nature. I understand that, but I know that they're sinners and they're not redeemed. You know, so I'm not going to appeal to their, you know, salvation. You know, these are two sinners going at it, but you know they also need to learn the interpersonal thing of, like the weaker kid needs. How do I get this thing from the big boy? You know, there's just lots of things. But I think part of it is because the parents' tendency is to rush in and rescue that child right away, so they have no adversity,
mm-hmm. and no risk.
Yeah, and so and think of, so. Let's go back to the sexual activity. Now with the phone, you have sexual activity and pleasure without. With less risk.
Yeah.
Because without you can't get a phone pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. But the problem is we don't see the damage because we're, like, damaging our brain.
Mm-hmm.
Our mind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Paul is all about the renewing of your mind. Like, hey, wait a minute. This mind thing's important?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, your example of watching a family out for dinner, no one is looking up. I see that all the time, and it's heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
I see that in my students when they come into the room because, you know, before we start class, they have, you know, they're walking with their heads, their earbuds in, their heads down, and they come. You know, a few weeks ago, we stopped playing a song, and immediately they start reaching. I was like, no, don't reach for your stupid phones just because we ended the last note.
Yep.
I mean, I remember distinctly sitting in band at times, hearing the last note and going, that was awesome. I don't even think they think about things like that now because they're so, I got to get back to my video game. I got to get back to that chat I was having.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to send a message across the room. That was awesome.
Yeah. What did Sasser call
everything.
It? Affluenza?
Everything.
Mm-hmm.
He called it affluenza, and he was talking about one of the cures for affluenza is coming up with work projects.
Yep.
The idea of sending your kid to a cattle farm, which he did with one of his daughters. The idea of finding a farmer and having him go work in the field for a few days of local areas.
I mean, you're doing your children a disservice if they don't have a part-time job.
And the thing about that even is we've got this mentality that, you know, we want 18-year-olds expect to step out of school after they go to college for 4 years and start making 70 and 80 grand.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the reality is, in the past, here's what happened. You started working when you were 14, 15, maybe even 13 if you lived on a farm and all that. And you got the jobs that nobody else wanted and that paid squat. And what we've done now is we've replaced that workforce because we're too lazy to deal with making our children do that. As parents, we don't want to hear their lip when we say, get out there and do that, because we've raised generations that expect, I'm not supposed to, you want me to take out the garbage? You want me to do this? You want me to go, you know, at our house when we went to see grandma, it was, you want me to snap the beans? You want me to go out there and pick the beans? You know, we were all,
But, oh, yeah, pea picking.
Right. But the thing is, we've replaced that.
That and shelling peas.
That road to success, we've replaced that by allowing the immigrants to do that work.
I used to bunk it, so.
And we're supposed to go to college, get this big degree so that we can step right out. And guess what? We're not finding those jobs and people willing to pay people like that.
That's nice.
Yeah. Well, that's something that, you know, the concept, and I don't know where that ever came from, that why the thought of, I deserve the high-ranking position because I have the degree. But just about any, I mean, look just about anywhere in America to see success, and you'll see someone that's probably worked their way to the top, where they have put in their time, and that's what has driven them to success.
Well, I was having a conversation with a young man, and I told him, I said, I want you to come to work tomorrow. And I said, I'll text you what time. And I thought I did, but he didn't. So at the time when he was supposed to report, I said to him, where are you? And he said, you didn't text me. Okay, all right. I said, come now. And I said, what do you think you should have done? And he wrote back, I don't know. So he shows up, and I said to him, I said, look, there's only three ways to earn money. Number one, you inherit it. Number two, you steal it. And number three, you work for it. I said, is there any probability you're going to inherit a lot of money? And he said, no. I said, do you think that you are willing to steal? No. I said, well, here's the bad news then. The only way you're going to get rich is if you work for it. And when your boss tells you something like, text me, and he doesn't text, then you say, hey, boss, you forgot to text me. What time am I coming to work? But there is a total lack of initiative.
Right.
Well, this was talking about the lack of independence.
Because they're not hungry to work. They're not hungry to work.
Right, because they don't understand the benefits of work, because they haven't had to understand the benefit of work. Going back to what you were talking about with my children, is because they realize, when you don't have money, you don't have things, you don't have...
Well, I was thinking about this, John, with your children as I was reading this, because I'm pretty familiar with all your children, seeing them grow up and everything. And you only have two scenarios here with poor children. Either they're poor and they feel sorry for their children, so they're poor, so they take money that they don't have and they give them a smartphone. Mm-hmm. Or they have parents that are poor and don't have money for it, and they're not going to cave to the parents, and then they don't have the smartphone, and they're actually better off for it because they don't. Mm-hmm. Those are the only two scenarios.
But nobody wants their kid to be depressed and be the one.
Exactly. So for all the parents that are affluent, and we've got a ton of them in our church, you have to be the bad guy and take them off their phone.
Yeah. You know, and Pastor, we had enough money that our girls did not have to work. Okay? And at the time, I didn't know local farmers and things of that nature, and I hadn't read Ben Sasser's book
right. And
all that. But even still, we had things you do around the house that you do because you're a member of the household. Period. Then we had things you can do for money. And you started out with, this is how much money you're going to make to do them. And then at the end of the week, for the items you didn't do, it was deducted from the amount of money you could have made. So you learned a cost-benefit. And they had to do a cost-benefit analysis every week of, well, I don't really have to do that because it's only required if I want to earn money for it. So this week I'm okay making $5 versus $10.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to do these two or three things. But they didn't get the $10 because they were promised $10. It was only if they worked and did these X number of jobs to get up to that point.
I mean, we're not going to get the smartphone away from them. Mom and Dad, you're not going to do that. So you got to figure out what you're going to do to compensate for it. Smartphones aren't going away. They're not going away. You know, I remember when I was a kid, Steve, you must remember the same thing. Television was the big Get your kids away from the television. Televisions are going
to
kill kids.
The
one-eyed monster.
Right, exactly.
We didn't have one.
Right.
We had one when I was real little, and it broke, and it was right after my daddy got saved and whatever and all of that, and he just said, we don't need one, never replaced it, and used to just tell us, go to the library, get a book.
You're probably better for it.
We went back and forth. That's how it was. Exasperated with it. I remember one time my dad was just so frustrated that he came home. We were all watching the television. The house wasn't clean. So he just picked the entire thing up, carried it out the house, and threw it down. Just bam. And we're not getting, you know, and it was, and we didn't have one for several years.
I didn't have one from when I was, like the first TV that I had was after Beth and I got married when we moved in the apartments. There was, mm-hmm. They had free basic cable.
Right.
So it was like for her birthday, we bought a TV, and we had the whole eight channels or 10, whatever it was.
Well, we had a TV.
Have one growing. You know, I think the last time I remember having a TV was like the early 70s.
Yeah, we had a TV the whole time.
And that was, at what, 11 o'clock or whatever? Or I think it was around, 10, 11 at night? It'd just go, the broadcaster say, we're now signing off. And it was just snow.
We had a TV. But
the problem, Steve, is this smartphone never signs off.
Right, it never
signs off.
And all the TV doesn't
don't
either.
Right,
yeah.
And the kids are exhausted.
Yeah.
Your student is sitting in school that you pay money for, and they're not learning because they're so exhausted. Because you have no control over it.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So
and because you're not a YouTube video.
Yeah.
I parented a very challenge. We took his phone away. We took it away.
Turned the Wi-Fi off at night.
We unplugged the internet because he worked himself around the blocks that we installed. But what he couldn't work around was the lack of electricity. It needed electricity. And it was in my closet, and I just jerked the cord out. So no internet, no phone, he goes to sleep.
We took the phones.
Right.
Took them to our room.
Parents aren't willing to do anything. I walked around church Sunday morning.
Oh, yeah.
People are glued to their... They don't even handshake.
No, it's the same on Wednesday night.
They're standing at their phone.
Wednesday night and you stop at the pew and they're oblivious that you're standing there. And it's
exactly.
Just, you either have to smack it to say hi,
or
you just
wave in front of it,
or you just walk past.
But walk around with a $5 bill in your hand and see how many you hand out in a night.
No, it's crazy. Yeah. That's the point of this article. We'll pick it up next week.
Somebody will take somebody on the other side to walk them over.
You remember the was it the Bulldog Run where we had beat Pastor Sean? Remember that video? That was how many years ago was that?
That was 2006, a long time
right?
ago, yeah.
And Jessica Burkholz had her phone and her mom slapped it out of her hand. You remember that video? But, I was thinking even back then it was a big deal, but now we had no idea what it was going to
be. It's out of control. It is out of control.
Yeah. I can't tell you the number of discipline issues I deal with.
That are smartphone related?
That are smartphone related, internet related.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, I can't imagine it.
Yep, it's out of control.
And technology as a whole, because the most recent buzz has been the AirPods, the wireless Bluetooth headphones. That now, it used to be if you were going to hide headphones, you had to put your hoodie up, and I remember, that was the thing that if you could get one of those hoodies that the pull strings were actually headphones. Or you had to sneak and have longer hair or something like that to hide the earbuds sitting in. And then now it's you see people and it's just you don't even realize it because they're so disconnected.
Have you seen the sunglasses?
Yeah.
That have the ear pods built into the sunglass stems.
Yep. All right, that's part one. We're going to wrap it up for this one. And, it's just too important of an issue. If you want to parent your children in this world, you're going to have to make changes. There's just no other way around it. We'll talk about some more. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.